Okay, what we're going to be doing here, starting this morning, is a series looking at the book of Ecclesiastes, which is it's a book which is known as, amongst the group of books, known as wisdom literature. It's very poetic. Unlike most of Proverbs, which is also a book in this theme, there's some books that we see historically that are out there that are wisdom books, which are not actually in the Bible. So there's actually a group of these types of this type of literature in Jewish thought before Christ. We see this a fair amount, but of course Proverbs we see in the Scriptures, and we see Ecclesiastes in the Scriptures, and they come from this. This type of literature, this type of writing. But it's very poetic. Unlike most of Proverbs, it's grouped into units of thought more succinctly than Proverbs is. And he's really, the author here is really, he's trying to figure out life in a fallen world. And he's really coming across the absurdities of life, inconsistencies that he sees, problems and inconsistencies, and it's his attempt to make sense of it all. And we see that the Lord brings him through this, and he really comes out with a real excellent nugget here. And the gist of it is, life is really absurd. Without God, it only makes sense with him. That's really kind of the gist of it. But now who the author was, we don't know with certainty, but it may have been Solomon. That's according to tradition that we know. We know of tradition that that it may have been, you know, that's according to church tradition, it was Solomon. A lot of Jewish tradition as well. However, he's not named. The author is not named. We look at verse 1 in chapter 1. It says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." So we don't know for sure who it is, but we find stuff in the text which seems to indicate it may be Solomon, simply because he's got more wisdom and more wealth than anyone who came before him. He's also a son of David. But that may not necessarily mean a king, although it's, you know, it could be. It says he was king in Jerusalem. Some people think that may just mean ruler, or he was in the ruling class. So there's different views on that. Bottom line is, it's probably not critical that we know, or else it would be clear. So it's just one of those kinds of things. So that's okay. So maybe Solomon, but we don't know with certainty whether or not it was Solomon. So he goes in here and he continues. And verse 2 really sets the stage for the book. And we're going to take this through all the way through chapter 3 to the middle of chapter 3, because really, in order to understand the book, we need to understand the introduction. And the introduction starts right here, and it goes all the way through to the middle of chapter 3. And if we stop reading it before we get to the middle of chapter 3, we can be pretty despairing, and it looks pretty bleak. But if we keep reading all the way through to the middle of chapter 3, it actually ties everything together in an introductory way and helps us to make sense of the entire book. And there's a lot of confusion over Ecclesiastes because many people see a lot of pessimism in it, and there is a certain amount of that. And yet, in the bigger picture that is painted here, it's actually optimistic, and there's actually some very good things that come out of this, very encouraging things. God really used this book in my life when I was in college, especially, and really wrestling with a number of doubts and just wrestling through issues with atheistic professors and things like that. And I saw it really showed me the absurdity of life without God, and that the only thing that made sense was life with God. And it's really the main message of this book. But anyways, let's pick it up, and we're going to work our way through this. We're going to go right through to the middle of chapter 3. So we're going to be reading a lot. We'll be stopping periodically, reflecting on some of it. But really, again, to really bring this all the way through from beginning to the end of the introduction is what's really critical in helping bring a good picture of what's being talked about in this book. So here he starts off. He says, "Vanity of vanities," verse 2, says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." That word vanity is used 38 times in this book. Without understanding the word vanity, if we don't understand that word, we're going to really have a hard time getting a hold of the meaning of this book. And part of the problem is there's a little bit of vagary in it. However, I think it's really helpful if we understand the literal meaning of the word vanity. The literal word is hebel in the Hebrew, and the word literally means vapor. And so think of a vapor. What is the characteristics of a vapor? It appears for an instant, and then it's gone, right? It's incredibly impermanent. It's incredibly brief, and it's over without a trace. And I think if we understand that meaning, and we use that understanding as we read through Ecclesiastes, it's really going to open up the book for us as to what he's really driving at here, at the incredible impermanence of life and things that go on in the universe. So he goes on, he says, James put it this way, and one of the things we see in Ecclesiastes 2 is we actually see throughout this, you can actually see there are certain things that Jesus taught and that the apostles taught, which actually tie back into certain things talked about in Ecclesiastes. So this is a really important book. A lot of times people struggle with it, and so they throw it out. It's kind of like, you know, in the realm of like Revelation or some of these books that people have a hard time with understanding. So we throw it out, but unfortunately we lose something when we do that. We don't want to throw this book out. There's really something important here. James says in chapter 4, verse 14, "What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes." And I think he's thinking about Ecclesiastes, the message of Ecclesiastes, vapor. You're like a vapor. You're here and then you're gone. Very shortly thereafter, practically without a trace. And so that's the way it is. All is vanity. Let's continue with it in verse 3. "What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. And around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, 'See, this is new'? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after." So he's saying, this is the situation. Everything is vanity. Even in nature, we see a certain futility in the processes of nature, right? I mean, the seasons come, the seasons go. They come back around again. They go back, they leave. They come, they go. The water evaporates, goes up into the clouds, it falls again. And it just seems like there's this endless cycle of repetition, and yet there's no permanence in it. It's like things are coming back around again. There's almost this dullness of repetition, this seeming meaningless repetition of forces, even in nature, and even in people's lives, even in the history of humankind, there seems to be a certain degree of repetition. So what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. So there's this incredible repetition even in human history. It's like people do the same kinds of things over and over again. I mean, the same kinds of futility over and over again. We see, you know, foolishness rising up again and again and again. Somebody thinks they've got some big, amazing new discovery and new idea, and the reality is somebody's thought of it before. And again, it's talking in terms of philosophy. It's not talking about iPhones or things like that. But it's, you know, certainly there's been cumulative things in terms of invention. But what you do see is you see this just this seeming futility of things going on and on and on. And then again, you see in verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. So again, the lack of permanence, the seeming repetition, you almost get a sense of sort of a despair. It's like just kind of despairing of there's no permanence in anything. I mean, everything is just gone. You know, it shows up and it's gone again. Before you know it, shows up, it's gone. There's certain the seeming repetition, this sort of seeming meaninglessness, emptiness. That's kind of the picture you get here. Verse 12, he says, "I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem." Okay, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So he says, I actually applied my heart. I wanted to try to figure out kind of the big picture. I wanted to try to get the big picture of what's going on under heaven. And he said, the conclusion I came to, there's just a lot of unhappiness. and a lot of the things that we're busy with, we can't seem to get happiness out of them. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vapor and a striving after the wind. So all is vanity, but again, think of that word vapor, right? It's like, it's there, it's gone. Can't hang on to it. No permanence. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. So he's saying one of the things he realized is that we're really very limited in our ability to change any of this. It's like our ability to impact this in a very just a natural sense is really, really limited. So what he's really doing, he's painting a picture of the limitations on us that we experience, that we have. Verse 16, I said in my heart, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So he says, wow. He says, I figured I was going to try to get the big picture and figure this all out. And I really applied myself to figure stuff out, to search things out. And I realized that I can't even pull it off, that there's just too much out there to try to understand, that it's too complicated, it's too complex. It's like chasing vapor again. Like, who catches vapor besides nobody? You know, he's like, so again, he's painting a picture once again of his own limitations. He's going, I tried to get the big picture, and I just can't, the picture is just so much bigger than I could ever possibly get a hold of. And so again, there's much vexation. Whoever increases knowledge increases sorrow. The more you learn about the world, the more depressing things you run across and you see. And so it actually can even lead to some sorrow to a certain extent. It can do that at times. Now, one of the things to notice about Ecclesiastes is he does say things, a lot of things he says are truisms, but they are not meant to be broadly applied to every situation. And that's important to realize also. So, for example, you see in other scriptures in Ecclesiastes, other verses where he talks about wisdom bringing joy. That's also true. So which is true? Well, actually, both are true. You actually do get joy through wisdom. It really does bring joy, and he does talk later about the importance of getting it, and it's much better to have it than not to have it. But what he is doing here is he's painting a picture of the impermanence or the inadequacy of human wisdom, of our ability to grasp things, that even if we've got wisdom, we really still have a great deal of limitations on that wisdom. There's a lot of limitations on it, and there's even some negative aspects to having wisdom. So any thoughts with any of this so far before we continue into this some more? Anybody have any comments, ideas? I think that the understanding of the word vanity, the understanding the literal meaning of that word, I think really helps. Really helps to understand the book. Vapor. It's like vapor, vapor. All is vapor. Vapor. It's all vapor, you know. Vapor and of vapors, you know. So again, temporary, temporary, temporary. No permanence, no permanence, no permanence, no permanence, no permanence. Temporary, temporary, temporary. Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. And that is what the preacher here in Ecclesiastes is really, he's come to grips with this reality. Now he continues on here, and really what he's doing throughout this book is he's kind of giving the journey, he's sharing the journey of his search for wisdom. So this is not only is this wisdom literature, there's a lot of poetry in here, and he's really creating a narrative. He's telling the story of the things that he discovered along the way. So we're kind of following the storyline of his life and his discoveries and the things he did to try to find out about wisdom and to try to figure out what makes the world tick and why things are the way they are. So he continues here in verse 1 of chapter 2. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. This also was vapor. Again, that word vanity, vapor. I said of laughter, it's mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? So again, in terms of the context is the laughter and the pleasure, it doesn't do any good in trying to get the big picture. That's the point he's trying to make. He's not saying laughter is bad. He's just saying it. Laughter and pleasure, just pursuing those things, doesn't help you come any closer to an understanding of how things are and the way things tick. He says it's no use for that particular thing. Verse 3, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart's still guiding me with wisdom. So he's like, well, maybe I'll party a little bit here, see if that helps. Does that make me wiser? And how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So he even partakes in some folly, which I don't recommend, but but he's like, I'll just see what that's like. I'll try that out a little bit. Okay, and if this was indeed Solomon who wrote this, then he may be referencing his falling into idolatry. Who knows, if he came back to his senses at the end of his life, which some people think he did, and that this was the product was Ecclesiastes. That's one view. But anyways, whatever the case, he tries that out. Till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. So he says, I tried to go for the big projects. I got involved in really big stuff, big impact stuff that a lot of people would notice. He says, I did that kind of stuff. Built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. So he's really pursuing enjoyment in the natural world by creating these really big, beautiful projects. Verse 6, I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, so he had a tremendous amount of resources. And I had slaves who were born in my house. He said, I had tons of people working for me. I became like a boss, like a manager, and I had all these people working for me. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of men. He says, I totally went full-born into entertainment. I like completely got engrossed in entertainment. I like sought the pleasures of entertainment, including women. He said, I did that. I went all that direction with it. Verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. So he is starting to hint at one thing positive here a little bit, but we'll see the limitations on it. But he says, I became great. He became like the man in Jerusalem. And he, because he had so much resource, he pretty much got whatever he wanted. I mean, a lot of times people think, man, if just had more money, if I could just get whatever I'd wanted, I'd be really happy, really satisfied, really fulfilled. He says, I actually got to that place in my life where I actually literally could get anything I wanted. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and this is what he's going to come to. He says, now he did find some pleasure in all his toil. He found this was the reward for his toil, as he found pleasure in the work. Now, the interesting thing to note is when we look back at the story of Genesis, God put Adam to work before the fall. So we can see that that work in and of itself is actually rewarding. It's meant to be rewarding. And so he did find some reward. He did find work to be rewarding. Now, the curse that happened because of the fall was that there's also a lot of frustration in work too. So it gets mixed with frustration. So there's a mix in there. And yet still, there is reward in work. And this is something that God created us for. And that's why there is a reward in it. Now, he goes on. He says, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. Again, think of the word vapor, which is literally what that word is. All was vapor and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. In other words, I did all these amazing things. I mean, incredible projects. I had all the resources at my disposal. I did it. It was awesome. It was a great job. I felt a certain degree of reward in all that work. When I looked at it, I said, this is cool. But then I realized there's nothing to be gained from this. In other words, it doesn't last. It's vapor. It's striving after wind. Like, even all these wonderful projects I make are going to eventually decay and fall apart, and nobody's going to think about them anymore. It's not going to have any impact on anybody. It's just going to totally become vapor and striving after wind. I mean, it's going to disappear. The whole thing's going to disappear. He's basically saying, I gained nothing of permanence. I wasn't able to get anything permanent out of all this. It just ends up being nothing.
And I agree that the work does have a certain reward. Mm-hmm. But the biggest reward I've ever got is from the work I poured into our children as they were growing.
Yes.
It's
yeah.
With them today.
Yeah. Investing in your children, yeah. We're going to get into. He is going to come eventually. This seems really despairing. Eventually, he's going to turn the corner on this, and he's going to put it in perspective. So again, that's why we're going to get through the entire introduction here, which is pretty lengthy. It's really the first. We have to get into the middle of chapter 3 till we finish the introduction here. So he continues here in verse 12 of chapter 2. He says, "So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done." He says, listen, even if even if somebody after me comes and, I mean, what else are they going to do besides what I did? I mean, even if they got like a perfect situation like I seem to have had for a while here, they can't really add anything permanent to it. There's just no permanence to it. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vapor, this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vapor, all is vanity, and a striving after the wind. So again, he says, I did begin to perceive, okay, it's actually better to be wise than not wise, like in kind of the scheme of life. It's really better. At least the wise person understands this stuff. At least they've got a grasp on reality that's just better than the fool. The fool isn't even concerned with these things. He ought to be, but he's not. He doesn't even get it. He's like totally just living in vanity and foolishness and pursuing vapor all the time, totally unaware of it, virtually oblivious to that fact. He says, at least the wise guy gets this. He's got eyes in his head. He can see the picture. That's better than not knowing the picture. But again, he sees the futility of all his pursuits in gaining anything of permanence. So I hated life. He says, I couldn't get anything permanent out of it, no matter what I did. And he said, when it's all said and done, I'm going to die just like the foolish guy dies. I mean, I'm going to get some sort of sickness. Something's going to happen to me. There's going to be an accident, whatever. Just the same kinds of thing that happens to a foolish person. I can't avoid that happening. It's going to happen just like it does to the fool. So what did I really gain from all this? That's what he's going, I hated life. This is where he's at now. So he continues. Verse 18, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all, for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. This also is a vapor, right? So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vapor or vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation. So there's the negative side to work, right? There's always problems at work, right? Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity or vapor. You know, how many times have people been having troubles at work or struggles with something at work, and they can't get to sleep at night, right? He goes, I experienced that too. He said, I had that frustration. He says, what I did is I looked at, again, concerning permanence for himself. He thought, well, at least if I can pass it on to my posterity, like what you were saying, you know, if I can pass it on to them and they can enjoy it and be wise with it and do something good with it. He goes, but I can't even control that. I can't even guarantee that they're going to make wise use of what I'm giving them. I have no guarantee that that's going to happen. And in any case, it won't even benefit me anyways. And what they and I have no ability to have firm control over my legacy. I can't control it. It's not in my power to do that. He goes, it's vapor. I lose control of it. I no longer can influence what my posterity will do when I'm dead. That's it. I can't impact it. He goes, frustrated. He says, I gave up to despair. And this is where you're coming. He says, I got to the point where I got despairing. It really seemed total emptiness, total vapor. Verse 24, now he's going to begin to hint at the solution to the problem. He's going to just start. There's a little bit of a hint's going to come in here. And we're going to start to see the situation turn around a bit. And he's going to put it into perspective that's going to really help. Verse 24, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. Oh, God. Okay. Now suddenly we have God comes into the picture. This is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he is given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vapor and a striving after wind. Now, he says, this is what I came to the conclusion. This is kind of a temporary, some of his initial conclusions here. He says, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat, drink, and find enjoyment in his toil. Those three things were three things that were given to us before the fall. Food, drink, work. Those are all good things God gave to us to be enjoyed. God declared them to be good. He said, this is good stuff. Good food, good drink, a good job, work, and getting some reward from your work. He says, that's good stuff. He says, but this is from the hand of God. He says, for who, apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? In other words, he's recognizing here that God has a role to play in really being able to properly enjoy these things in a way that is going to have greater depth to it, right? And ultimately, God is the one who provides for our needs, right? And so he says, who can eat? I mean, the fact that your needs are met and you got food to eat is the gift of God. The fact that you can enjoy your job, that's the way God made us. That's his gift to us. He created us to enjoy work. So without him in the picture, you wouldn't even be able to have these minimal enjoyments in life. Even these little temporary enjoyments that you have in life, without God, you wouldn't even have those. So what he's doing here is he's beginning to bring God into the picture. And the despair is just beginning to lift a little bit here. He's starting to say, the little things that you do enjoy, even the temporary stuff, even the vapor, that actually is a gift of God. For verse 26, for to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give the one who pleases God. So here when he says wisdom and knowledge and joy, God has given it to the one who pleases him. Wisdom and knowledge come from right relationship with God. The fool can't get that stuff. He says, what you can get if you please God is you can get wisdom, knowledge, and joy. A fool can get a certain amount of joy temporarily in certain things and can find some enjoyment in his work, but he doesn't see the big picture. He can't get wisdom without God. He can't begin to see things and even see the vanity of life properly, the emptiness and the vapor of life without wisdom, without God. Now he says, but to the sinner he is given the business of gathering, collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. And this is interesting because the business of gathering, collecting is what? Is work. God is saying, listen, the wise person, the one who pleases God, actually gets more of the fringe benefits from the labor of the fool, of the one who doesn't please God, of the one who doesn't know God. And we see that, right? Because, you know, what happens is people work, right? Income is generated. The government gets taxes. It pays police officers to keep law and order, right? It allows a certain amount of law and order. We have armed forces to protect us. I mean, we have these benefits from many unbelievers working and their tax money getting collected and certain services being done. But who gets to benefit the most from that? It's actually the one who pleases God who benefits the most from that, because the one who pleases God actually has wisdom to appropriately look at life in a proper way and has knowledge to understand things much better, and so can actually have more enjoyment in this temporary life than the fool can. So the benefit is actually greater for the one who pleases God than for the one who isn't. And even the labor and the toil of the fool benefits the one that pleases God more. Does that make sense? It's like it kind of all, it actually, we have greater benefit So he's saying, I'm beginning to see this connection here with God. There's this connection with God. There is some benefit to the one who pleases God. But this also is vapor and a striving after the wind. So he's saying, listen, even though there's a little bit of benefit here, it's still temporary, it's still vapor. We still haven't gotten to the permanence thing. There's still an important, you know, how do we get permanence out of all this? Okay, glad you asked. He's going to tell us, right? Chapter 3, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He, God, has made everything beautiful in its time. There's the key redemptive factor. All this temporary vapor stuff that vanishes, God is actually at work in the midst of all these very temporary things that are going on in our lives. And there's these seasons in our life. And what seems to be just chaos so many times, just kind of life happening, right? God is actually putting something beautiful together out of all this. Something really beautiful is taking place in the midst of seeming, you know, mindless chaos and endless cycles and all this stuff going on. God is actually, has set things up like this because he's actually at work and he's actually doing something. That's really encouraging. That's very encouraging. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Now, also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning. So this is an important factor, too. God has actually given us the ability to think in terms of eternity. He's actually put that into us, and that's in every man's heart. And yet, at the same time, he's not allowed us to have the ability to fully grasp it. He's like placed great limitations upon us. So what happens is there's this dynamic tension going on in us. It's partly due to the fall, and it's partly due to our human limitations. We have this inability to control so many events out there and this inability to figure out how it all fits together. And yet we have a desire for it. And we have this realization that eternity is really important, like stuff goes on forever, and that there's something very, very important about this. And clearly that's happening. Now he says, God has done, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. So again, he says, what I realized, okay, we've got this yearning for eternity, and yet we've got this very temporal existence. He says in verse 12, I perceived there's nothing better than them to be joyful, do good as long as they live. So now he says it's really important to have joy, to do good, to do what's good. And he's going to come around to that, why that's so important in just a second. And also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. Again, eating, drinking, taking pleasure in your work, all that was given to us before the fall. So he says, that's God's gift to man, that God made us to enjoy these things. So it's good to do that. Now, verse 14, I perceived, and here's the key, these next two verses, the whole book hinges on these two. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. And here's the key, and this is what the whole book hinges on, and this is what makes this an optimistic rather than a pessimistic book. And that is this, whatever God does endures forever. Whatever God does, the only way, remember he's been talking about impermanence, vapor, 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 vapor. Really, that word for vanity, right? Or the word for vanity is vapor. See, impermanence, 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 impermanence. Everything's leaving, everything's fleeting, everything's futility. And then he goes, not futility. Whatever God does endures forever, permanence. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. He goes, God's put eternity in our hearts, and he's made us aware of the futility. If we're wise, we see the futility of this life, how temporary it is. And what it, and God has purposely set up that dynamic tension. Why? So that we would realize we need him, that we would fear him, that we would go, I need God. God is the only one who can rescue me from this impermanence and this vapor and this vanity that I'm living in. He's the only one who can bring something permanent out of everything that's so impermanent. He does it. God has purposely set it up so that people fear before him. God, this is the grace of God to allow us to be in this despairing situation so that we'll call out to him and seek him. That's the grace of God. So that we'll grope for him and find him and find permanence in him. And ultimately, it's in Christ, right? Verse 15, that which is already has been, that which is to be already has been. Again, the futility, the futility. And God seeks what has been driven away. And here's the key. All that futility, all that vapor, there's only one who can go back into the past and grab the vapor and bring something permanent out of it. There's only one who can do that. Only God can do that. He's the only one who can do it. And only what he does is what is permanent and what lasts forever. And that's why it's absolutely critical we're rightly connected with him. Because if we're rightly connected with God through Jesus Christ, we know because of the gospel today, right? Through the gospel, we believe the gospel. When we're rightly connected with God through Jesus Christ, we have hope now. Now, everything we do in this very impermanent, very vaporous life that just vanishes before it even starts, hardly. It's like it's a mist, right? James says, you're a mist. You're like a vapor. You appear for a minute, you're gone. He says, now, Ecclesiastes shows us, this is where the permanence lies. God is the one who can go after that which has been driven away. God is the one who can go after the vapor. He's the one who can bring something permanent out of it. And there's the hope. There's the optimism in Ecclesiastes. And that's the critical part. Now, as we work our way through this book, we will see he's going to focus on different things as we work through this. But we have to maintain this big picture because that's the big picture he came to. That's the end of his introduction. Now, he's gonna go back into a lot of temporary things. He's going to deal with some real fine-tooth details. He's going to talk about the vapor in a lot of the activities of life. But it's always, he's going to periodically refer back to fearing God and wisdom and the importance of doing the right thing because God is going to bring us to account. Again, there's the permanent side, right? There's all this vapor. There's all this impermanence. And then there's the only thing permanent, God and what he does. And the fact that he can go after the vapor. He can bring it back. He can make sense of it. He's the one who can take all the seasons of our life, all the seeming chaos and all the events of life, and he can weave something beautiful out of it. He can take something really lovely and beautiful out of what seems to be just, you know, emptiness and brokenness and despair and vapor and impermanence. There's permanence in him. Isn't that wonderful? I love that. And that's really, in a nutshell, the message of Ecclesiastes. And that's the introduction. That's the end of the introduction of Ecclesiasties. And we can look through, we'll look through at some of the details of that as we work our way through. But that's the big picture. Those are the two big things, is that life is vaporous, it's brief, it's impermanent, and yet in God, in Christ, we know now, the fear of God is the only thing that makes sense because God will bring everything into judgment. Only he can bring about permanence for us. Only what he does remains. And thank God we know about the resurrection of Jesus, and we have hope for the age to come because of him. He can take that which has been driven away and bring it back. So any thoughts on that? Any closing thoughts on any of that in Ecclesiastes? But it starts off looking pretty bleak, and yet we end up with this really nice ending to the introduction, the fact that God can bring permanence out of it. Yes, honey, you're going to say something. That's my wife, by the way, if you're listening to the tape. Yeah. Yeah. Food can there. Oh, that we will. Yeah, the wedding feast of the Lamb, right? Right. Food and drink is really fun, and we're going to get to eat and drink for all eternity. The wedding feast of the Lamb is just that. It's a feast. And Jesus ate, like you said, he ate fish and bread after he rose again from the dead. So it's not like we're going to stop eating. Food and drink was meant to be enjoyed, and we're going to get to enjoy it forever. I think that's pretty cool.
I like that idea.
Yeah, and it won't make our bodies decay like they do now, right? Isn't that wonderful? Food and drink's going to be around forever. Yeah, as is work. But it's going to be enjoyable work. The pain and the vexation due to the fall and the futility of it is going to be out of the picture in the age to come. Yeah, work without smashed fingers, without the pain, the vexation, the frustration, and the idea this isn't going to last. No, actually, it is going to last in the age to come. And that's the beauty of and all those things were meant to be permanent, and yet they aren't because of the fall. And yet in God they are, and they will have permanence. And yeah, that's wonderful. Father, we thank you that you love us and that in you we can find permanence. In you we have hope. In you, you can take that which is vapor and bring it back and bring something permanent out of it. You're the only one that can do that. And so, Lord, that's why we live life with our eyes wide open, realizing it's worth it to live for you. It's worth it to follow you with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. It's worth it to love you and to love people and to pursue your kingdom first. It's worth it. And Father, that's what we do, Lord. We just surrender ourselves to you afresh, and we do it in Jesus' name. Amen.